You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. According to a recent study, female artists make up only 10% of the airplay on country music radio. But other polling shows that's not exactly what people want. We'll look at why that gender gap exists and what's being done to close it. That's coming up.
Now, Congress and the Trump administration are working on legislation to deal with the novel coronavirus. One key area of focus is paid sick leave.
The Trump administration has said it's interested in extending paid leave for hourly workers who can't work during the outbreak. But our next guest wants legislation to go further, mandating paid sick leave for workers and creating 2 weeks of paid sick leave available for public health emergencies.
Tammy Baldwin is a Democrat representing Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate. She helped introduce that bill with other Democrats. Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, spell out for us, please, what this legislation on paid sick leave would do.
Well, this would mandate that low-income wage workers get 14 days of paid sick leave to be used during a public health emergency, including this one. And it was fashioned, the lead author of this is my colleague, Senator Patty Murray, who represents the state of Washington, where they are already seeing crisis because many of the workers who have been exposed to somebody with the coronavirus, with the COVID-19, have been ordered to go home. They have no income. They live paycheck to paycheck and literally have to weigh their ability to pay the rent and buy food against the instructions to stay home. Additionally, we're seeing in states that are, you know, more impacted so far than Wisconsin is, that we're seeing places like child care centers or elementary schools close. And when that happens, parents have to responsibly make sure their children are okay. That, too, may mean that a wage worker has to remain home to care for their children if they can't afford other child care or other arrangements. And so we're seeing this sort of immediate impact of the public health crisis especially hit low-wage workers.
Who would end up paying for this? Is it the employer who covers the cost of this emergency sick leave? Is this coming from the federal government or some combination?
Yeah, so this is, as introduced, a bill that would require employers to provide immediately at least 14 days of paid sick leave during a public health emergency, including this one. This is something that has yet to be debated, but is in response to what we're seeing happening around the country. And, you know, that leaves certainly a very valid question about employers that don't have the wherewithal to be able to afford this. So what we're doing is working with the Trump administration. They have recommended, or I shouldn't say recommended, they are considering some pretty huge tax breaks for big businesses impacted by COVID-19, like the airlines, the cruise ship industry, and other big businesses. I think if there's going to be a tax break plan to stimulate the economy, he should instead focus that on the small businesses precisely so that they can afford to provide the paid sick leave for their employees.
Talking to Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat, talking about congressional responses and the administration response to the novel coronavirus. Now, we see in the news today there's an effort to quickly pass this legislation, blocked from getting quick approval by Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. What do you make of that that delay now?
Well, I think the point, first of all, it's disappointing that there isn't a greater sense of urgency, especially as Congress is likely to be in a week-long recess next week. This is going to be an emergency that is being dealt with all over the country, and I would hate for us to not be in session and at least debating and dealing with this. I do understand that it's a rather big step and does need a debate, but let us deal with this issue with some significant sense of urgency.
You sent a letter to President Trump along with other Democrats today about his response to the coronavirus. What kind of things did you bring up in that letter?
Well, there are a number of, a number of communications that are going on. So one letter that I joined in to the administration actually was to Secretary Betsy DeVos of the Department of Education. We're dealing with the issue of school closures. We're dealing with the issues in higher education of endeavoring to teach the remaining semester of coursework online. And we're looking at the potential with these measures of some very significant inequities between students. If you are, for example, a Wisconsin student in a rural area and don't have access to broadband, how are you going to be able to reap the benefits of your tuition dollars if that's something that's not available? But in addition, you reference other communications. So in a letter to President Trump, we've really talked about what sort of economic stimulus package we should be debating. And I think that, as I just discussed with you, I think issues like helping the families most immediately harmed would be the best stimulus and the best public health policy, rather than some of the proposals that President Trump was floating that are very indirect in terms of both fighting the disease and trying to stem its spread versus tax breaks for big corporations.
Now, some Republicans have raised concern that Democrats, and they're mostly focusing on the House here, will use this novel coronavirus outbreak as an excuse to try to pass legislation that Democrats have wanted for a long time anyway. What would you say to concerns, political concerns along those lines?
So I think that there's nothing partisan about this epidemic. It is going to affect communities in red states and blue states and everything in between. And that we have to rise up and work together to identify the things that public policy and federal funding can do to address this emergency. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't point out mistakes and learn from mistakes along the way, but it's not about Democrats or Republicans or independents. It's about fighting for the health and safety of our constituents.
And very briefly, Senator Baldwin, you're in a line of work with a lot of in-person meetings with people, a lot of crowds sometimes. Is there a feeling that, hey, we need to change the way we do our business a little bit?
You know, there's been informal discussion, and as of today, the head health expert who's sort of in charge of the health and wellness of people on Capitol Hill has issued some guidance. Right now, this is not binding guidance for members of Congress and their staffs, but suggestive recommendations. I do think that it will also be important as this week wraps up that the leadership of both houses of Congress, in consultation with the building management, known as the architect of the Capitol, and the attending physician for Congress, all consult about rational steps moving forward.
Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us. That's Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin with us today to talk about her support for paid sick leave legislation in response to the novel coronavirus. More coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. Coming up, aside from being your go-to game for making fair decisions quickly, Rock, Paper, Scissors also has its own professional leagues and players. We learn about the history of the game.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about Freemasons in northern Wisconsin.
There are several regional lodges of Freemasons in Wisconsin's North Woods, but the network has always had an air of mystery. That got us wondering about the history of these places. What is the role of a Masonic temple in a community? Mackenzie Martin headed to the Rhinelander Masonic Temple to find out as part of WXPR's Curious North series.
There's a certain kind of look that the most famous Masonic temples have. Big white columns, stained glass windows. Though smaller than some, the Masonic Temple in Rhinelander has been around since 1930 and fits right in. Once you're inside, the most interesting room is arguably the lodge room, where ceremonies take place.
Are you ready to see the coolest room in Rhinelander?
Well, you stay here and I'll turn the lights on first.
The high ceilings of the lodge room make it feel bigger than it already is. Elevated in the back of the room are three chairs beneath an illuminated letter G. Tony Jones is the one leading a tour of the Rhinelander Masonic Temple today, because he's currently in charge of it. This is his official title.
I am the worshipful master.
He points out one of the most famous symbols to me, the square and compasses with the letter G.
The compasses teach us to circumscribe our behavior and keep us within due bounds of all mankind. And the G represents geometry, but in a bigger sense, it represents God.
Jones acknowledges that there is still a certain air of mystery about the Freemasons. But he says the Masons are mostly just a group of men who support one another as they try to be better versions of themselves. He says that the Rhinelander Masonic Temple is not a mysterious place.
You know, you don't open up a door and all of a sudden there's a half a dozen rolls from the library to Alexandretta.
As is the case for many small towns, the Masons were instrumental in building Rhinelander in the early days. In 1930, the town of Rhinelander raised $50,000 to build the Masonic Temple.
Which is a tremendous amount of money for a town this size going through a depression.
They're also the oldest civic group, and they laid the cornerstone for the library and the courthouse. Whole rooms upstairs are full of historical portraits of Rhinelander's early Masons.
You start seeing some of the street names when you start looking at the roles of members here, of what they did, the school board, the telephone company. You know, it's almost limitless what these men came up here to do. And then when you look at all these pictures, they came up here by wagon train or on foot, and they built something out of the woods.
Stories like this are why some people think the Freemasons run the world. And in a way, they kind of have. Many United States presidents were Masons, and Jones admits that when he travels, he has taken advantage of the vast network and been welcomed into many lodges. He says the way Masons identify each other is something he likes to keep secret. Today, the Rhinelander Masons are still a men's-only lodge, but otherwise they're open to new members as long as they believe in some form of a higher power.
The three major tenets of Freemasonry are friendship, morality, and brotherly love. Part of being a Freemason is the ability to give back to your community.
Giving back to the community is a huge part of what their Masonic Lodge is trying to do now. But it didn't used to be like that. It all changed about 2 years ago, prompted by a decision from Wisconsin's Grand Lodge.
The most worshipful Grand Master of the state of Wisconsin sent a note, an edict out to all the lodges saying it's time to become family friendly again. And we took that to heart and said it's time to open our doors.
So they decided to bring the Masonic Temple back to the old days of being a community building. They even host weddings and other parties now. And Jones feels like they're now using the building for the purpose it was meant to be used for. Meanwhile, across the country, many Masonic lodges have had to downsize and move out of their temples because there are less Masons than there used to be. So in the end, what purpose do Masonic temples serve in the community? It depends on the community. No matter what Masonic temple you're in, though, there's likely a lot of history and a few secrets.
WXPR's Mackenzie Martin brought us that story as part of their Curious North series. It's a lot like WPR's Wisconsin Project, where we answer audience questions in Wisconsin Life segments. To submit your question, go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, take a listen to this exciting moment without much context. It's a sporting event. We'll tell you what sport in just a moment.
The bout we've been waiting for. Here we go. Sears throws a textbook paper to jump ahead. Julie, though, slowed the pace, which should work to her advantage.
That was the title match of the 2007 United States Rock, Paper, Scissors Championship in Las Vegas. You heard me right. Those are professional rock, paper, scissors.
But before we got to this point in history where rock, paper, scissors is part of pop culture, there was a long history of the game making its way to us from China.
Anna Ramanan is a writer, editor, and producer. She's the global content editor for Time Out New York and has written for publications like Forbes and Fortune magazine. Her piece for Popular Mechanics is called The Long Winding History of Rock, Paper, Scissors. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I'm excited.
So, Anna, I guess first things first, are you or did you play rock, paper, scissors when you were a kid?
Yes, I definitely played rock, paper, scissors, and it's interesting because I'm in my 30s now, and I didn't know that there was such an interesting, elaborate history behind the game that I played for so long when I was little, and I still play now to make some decisions. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, we kind of always take it as a given. I remember playing it when I was a kid. It would be how, you know, my cousins and I would settle disagreements, and it was just fascinating to read your article because it seems like, you know, as I said, it's a given, but it has this long history. Can you talk about where rock, paper, scissors, as we know it today, originated?
Yes. So the origins are actually, it started a long time ago in China. The first mention of something that resembles the game that we play today is found in a Chinese book that's called Wuzazu. In it, the game wasn't called rock, paper, scissors. It was actually called Shou Xiling. And it dates back to sometime between like 200 and BC and 200 AD, and it's pegged to the Chinese Han dynasty. The next time we see it is actually in Japan. And interestingly, a lot of people think that Japan is actually the birthplace of the game, but that's not really the case. It really is, it came to Japan through contact with China. And in Japan, the game was called Sansukumi Ken, which literally means three are afraid of one another, which obviously is a call to the way you play the game. And it really was a series of different hand gestures, and they were actually different symbols. It wasn't rock, paper, scissors. It was a slug. It was a frog, and it changed throughout. Then eventually it obviously came to the West as well and is the rock, paper, scissors that we play today.
Yeah, it's interesting. It sounds like the trajectory from China and then a little east to Japan where it got its footing there and then migrated to the West. And it sounds like there are places along the Mediterranean that have their own version. But it all comes down to, you know, these same three things. One thing is afraid of the other. And, you know, rock beats scissors. Scissors beats paper. Paper beats rock. And a lot of people use it to make decisions. And, you know, it feels like an interesting way to make a decision. Why did this become the go-to insofar as we know?
Well, it is mostly, I would really say 99% of it is a game of luck and it's complete randomness. It has been studied as a mind game, though, because now there are actually worldwide competitions of rock, paper, scissors, believe it or not. And there is some sort of strategy involved. But what's interesting, and going back to your question of why is it used as a decision-making tool, it's really because it's a random game. Like, you don't know what the opponent is going to do, and you sometimes don't even know what you're going to do. But in these worldwide competitions, they realize that, well, your chances of winning involve a random selection of moves, so the whole point is to be as random as possible. But can humans really truly be random is the question that they're trying to answer, and I guess there's no answer really to that, but the more random you are, the greater your chance of winning because your opponent cannot really guess your next move.
And you get into that in your article that the people who are really good at rock, paper, scissors are kids because they don't have the same sort of like decision level making. They do make decisions, but they can still operate more randomly. Was that interesting to come across when you were looking at rock, paper, scissors for this article?
Yeah, I mean, it was super interesting because I never really thought of it. And it's true. Kids have the ability not to overthink just about anything. They're very, direct in what they do, and they just kind of do the first thing that comes to their head. So that makes them very hard opponents to beat because the whole point is that we're trying to kind of guess what our opponent is going to do.
And, you know, we were talking about the fact that this is a game of luck and randomness. You also mentioned that people are really into trying to beat the game, beat their opponent, and that there are now competitions across the world. Can you talk about that, about how this has reached sort of ESPN level coverage at points?
So it's crazy to me that this is even covered in any sort of global competition, but it is. And I think it's because people were able to determine a tiny bit of strategy. And I think that when that comes into the picture, it automatically translates into some sort of competition. So what these pro players really do is they use gambits. They're called gambits. And they're basically a pre-selected series of moves that these pro players go into the game already know. They basically already know the moves that they're going to make. And they do that to really, really, really minimize certain ticks that they may have that may signal to the opponent the move that they're about to make. So they go in prepared. They know exactly what they're going to do. And that way they try to, again, maximize that randomness for the opponent. In total, there are actually 27 gambits. There are like 27 series of moves, potential moves, based on the three, signs that we could use while playing. But only 8 of these 27 gambits are widely used. And it's interesting, they have very, very, cute and interesting names, like the Fistful of Dollars is rock, paper, paper. The scissor sandwich, as you can imagine, is paper, scissors, paper. And there's 8 of them, and they have these names, and that's really what these pro players use in these competitions.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for chatting with me about this. This was really fun.
Of course. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we have a little more understanding of the game now when we play and make decisions through it.
That was Anna Ramanan. She's a writer, editor, and producer. She's also the global editor for Time Out magazine. Her piece for Popular Mechanics is called The Long Winding History of Rock, Paper, Scissors.
Coming up, we'll talk about our guest's call to close the gender gap on country music radio. A lot more men end up on country radio than women, according to recent data. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the news about the spread of COVID-19 can be stressful for adults, and children have even less context and experience to rely on. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests talk about the best ways to communicate with kids about the disease. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, after 53 weeks on the Billboard 200 Hot Country Songs list, Maren Morris's song The Bones made it to the top spot this week.
It's her first number one hit on that chart. She's the first woman to rule it solo in about 3.5 years. The song has also reached the top of several other country music lists.
Her achievement is a big win for those who say country music is biased toward male artists, especially on the radio. A University of Ottawa professor concluded that female artists made up just 10% of airplay on country stations in 2019, and when they did get on the air, it tended to happen during off hours.
Industry executives say fans prefer male voices, but new polling shows the vast majority of country radio listeners say women should get the same airtime as men.
Our next guest wrote a column in USA Today saying radio stations need to do a lot better. Ken Paulson is a professor of the Recording Industry Department and director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University. He's a former editor-in-chief at USA Today. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, how big a deal is it, before we get into the numbers at radio stations, that the top song in country music right now is by a woman?
Well, it's symbolic, but it's almost more symbolic of the lack of women on radio than anything else, that it becomes essentially a news story that a woman finally got to number one in country radio. It's been a long dry spell for creative women and even women, who are 30 or 35. Country music has not been particularly embracing of either diversity are of age and certainly not of women.
And we've seen a couple comments over the years from industry insiders. One country music programmer mentioned that there was a rule that they couldn't play two female artists back to back. And then in 2015, a consultant named Keith Hill said, I'm going to quote here, if you want to make ratings in country radio, take females out. I play great female records. They're just not the lettuce in our salad. The lettuce is Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton, Keith Urban, and artists like that. The tomatoes of our salad are the females. These were comments not well received by many, I think.
No, it was, in fact, it inspired an entire movement in Nashville. A group of three industry veterans, women, formed a group called Change the Conversation, which really meant, can we please stop talking about why women are not on the air? And so what we're seeing now is with great frequency, a member of the radio industry will say something incredibly stupid, and then someone like Casey Musgraves lets them have it, and then we have another round of news coverage. And in part, that's what led to this column in USA Today that we're talking about today.
It seems like there's some self-fulfilling prophecy here. If you say, well, women aren't popular, so they're not going to be on our station very much. And if nobody hears women on the stations that play country music, then it's going to be hard for women to get popular. Is that the cycle we're in?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And when radio stations say, hey, we play women, and then you look at when they play women, and you realize it's after midnight and before 6 a.m. So people are not catching on creatively. Talented people who otherwise should have an audience, but they're not getting played enough. We all know the nature of pop music anyway. You know, songs that you didn't even like the first time you heard it. After you've heard it 200 times, you get married to it. You know, it's just – it's going to be a song in your head for the rest of your life. If women are not on country radio – there's no habit building. There's nobody's calling in a request line to say, I need to hear this fabulous new song by Brandi Clark.
Talking to Ken Paulson from Middle Tennessee State University, he wrote a column in USA Today looking at the lack of women on country music radio. This has been an ongoing issue. I want to get back to Maren Morris. Now, that song, The Bones, we heard a bit of, spent two consecutive weeks on top of the media-based chart. First time since 2012 that a woman had pulled off that feat. Here's what Morris had to say on Twitter. She wrote, 2 weeks at number one. If I can be honest, I really thought the only way this could ever happen is if I was the feature artist on a guy's song. Sitting here seeing my name at the top of the chart at all is rare, but to break this 8-year streak just feels so unbelievable. So, I mean, it's notable, but it seems like everybody knows how rare this is, and nothing seems to change, Ken.
Well, that's what's so maddening about country radio. You know, when other industries get accused of being sexist, you know, or white, you know, that you heard all the Oscars so white talk. You know, the Academy Awards quickly kicked into action. Public relations people, statements of apology. We're going to fix this. We're going to get more diversity into the Academy. Throughout industries, people are conscious of when they're being criticized, and immediately they circle the wagons and then hire a PR person. Radio doesn't do that. It just shrugs. It says things like, well, our listeners don't want to hear women, so we don't play women. It's an industry without shame. And what's so remarkable, it's just a clear bias against female performers, and they just act like it's business as usual. It's really quite shameful.
Is this just a radio thing, or is this a wider thing, do you think, in the country music industry?
Well, country radio has always been a force unto itself. You know, you think about the pop radio that an entire generation listened to, 60s, 70s. You could turn on the radio and you would hear Earth, Wind & Fire and the Motown records, all those black artists. You would hear Charlie Rich and Merle Haggard and country artists. And you would hear every possible version of music because if it was cool, if it was fun, if you could dance to it, it got on the radio. Well, there's been retrenchment in pop where more and more the music sounds the same. But in country, they never opened the doors. They had, you know, one black artist named Charlie Pride who was successful. And then there'd be others over time. Darius Rucker recently has been successful in country music. But, you know, even now we have like three charting black artists. And so we've lost ground on women, but also not made any significant progress in terms of diversity. in country music. Now, what they will tell you, country radio programmers will tell you, they've got studies. They ask their listeners what they want to hear. And that sounds to me a lot like blaming the audience, saying, well, they're not willing to embrace diversity, so we're not. You know, there's an affirmative duty to use the public airwaves, as you well know, at Wisconsin mm-hmm. Public Radio, to better the community, to serve the public, to serve all the public. And when they've decided it's in their interest not to play women, first of all, they may be wrong. But secondly, how do you write off an entire gender and act like you're living up to the obligations you have under the license from the FCC?
Well, on top of that, there's a poll. I think this came out last month from Country Music Television. They found that 84% of country music listeners say at least women should get equal airplay as men. 28% said they'd listen to country radio more if women were better represented. So at least according to that one poll by, you know, an interested country music outlet, there is some appetite out there, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. And the brilliance of artists in country music today. I mean, there are so many phenomenal people. Brandi Carlile is one, you know, one of the most talented women on the planet. She should be the, you know, the counterpart to Lady Gaga or Carrie Underwood in her genre, but it's just not happening. Carrie Underwood, by the way, is the one exception. I mean, she's a woman who's constantly on the charts, not number one, but there are always those. There are three or four women who do get airplay, and that allows radio to point to that and say, see, we do play women. But it has never been a very embracing kind of format. And, you know, Dolly Parton, as talented as she is, always played second fiddle to, pardon the pun, to Porter Wagoner. And she had to really fight to break out from under his shadow. Women were treated as wives or people who were cheated on, and there have rarely been independent voices in country music for women. Now they're just like no voices for women.
Now, Reba McEntire, another big name, the only woman ranked on Billboard's top 10 country music artists of all time. She was asked last year before hosting the Academy of Country Music Awards. She was interviewed on PBS NewsHour. She was asked about the nominees for Entertainer of the Year all being men. Here's a listen.
Disappointing. Didn't surprise me. But when anything like that happens, I just know us gals, we got to work harder. We got to support each other. We got to get in there next year. It's got to change.
And this year, Carrie Underwood, one of the five nominees. But I don't know. I imagine women in country music are already working pretty hard.
Right. I mean, I was surprised to hear Reba, you know, kind of say, you know, it's up to us to make a difference. I mean, it's great that women are unified and we're hearing more voices and more, you know, loud voices from female artists. But the industry as a whole has got to feel some shame. The executives, whether they're men or women, have to say, this is just wrong. This is 2020. You know, this is our Me Too, and we have to fix it. And that is not happening. I do give credit to CMT. You mentioned them earlier. They have promised to play 50% women in their videos. The only downside is CMT doesn't play a lot of videos anymore. It's other programming, but their heart is in the right place. They're taking a stand, and we need more of that.
We're talking about country music radio and why there's so little airplay for women artists. Ken Paulson is with us. He's a professor of the Recording Industry Department and director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University. He wrote a piece about this in USA Today.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to country music on the radio? Have you noticed male artists getting more airplay than female ones? Do you find yourself listening to one gender more than the other? What do you think needs to be done, if anything, to close the gender gap in country music? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. That was Fancy by Reba McEntire, a big hit for her back in 1990.
We're looking at a gender gap in country music, especially on the radio. According to recent data, women artists make up only 10% of the airplay on country stations, and that tends to happen in off hours. We're talking to Ken Paulson, professor of the Recording Industry Department at Middle Tennessee State University. He wrote about this in USA Today.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of country music? How do you feel about the industry's gender gap? Do you find yourself gravitating more to songs by men or women? You can tell us about your favorite female artist, past or present, and why you are into her at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Let's go to a caller. Daryl is with us in Poinette. Daryl, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up?
Well, I wanted to bring up the deal that there's no female instrumentalists like there are men instrumentalists in country music. When's the last time you heard of somebody like Barbara Mandrell, who plays steel guitar fantastically well, but who else?
Daryl, thanks for the call. Yeah, we focus a lot on the vocalists in country music as much as anywhere else. Ken, how about the backing bands?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because you would almost say there's a conspiracy against instrumentals, period. We all remember dueling banjos. What's the last country music instrumental you've ever heard be a hit in America? It's been a while. Instrumentals are something that have all fallen out of fashion. I will tell you, though, here's the good news. People like Rhonda Vincent and so many other talented instrumentalists are alive and well in a genre called Americana. Americana music is a melding of folk and rock and alternative country music. And there's a lot of great instrumentalists there doing very well. You know, Alison Krauss is a good example of that. There are people who also sing and play and have been successful. So it may be that country music has decided it's going to be all about young men singing about women in cutoffs and drinking a lot. But there's still a lot of great music out there. You just have to look a little harder.
Bring on another caller. Thanks, Daryl. We'll go to Kate now in Barneveld. Kate, hi.
Hi. I'm going to ask a question slash comment, and then I'm probably going to listen off the air because I'm driving. So my daughter, my teen daughter, is very into country music and extremely involved in supporting the female, especially the female singers that she is interested in. And as an older person, I'm just wondering what kind of message this exclusion or suppression of women in country music is sending, particularly to our next generation of listeners.
And Kate, before I let you go, I want to ask, does your teen daughter, you know, wait for it to come to her on radio, or does she seek out these artists on, you know, a streaming service or SoundCloud or whatever?
Everything, all of the above. She'll get it any way she can. So, you know, I don't feel like she, you know, is limited just to what's playing on the radio. But at the same time, what's playing on the radio, you know, is influencing what she's more likely to hear. And if somebody was not quite as passionate or aggressive about seeking it out, you know, she's involved more in you know, some country music, especially women in country music communities online and stuff. And so she has those opportunities because she seeks them out.
Kate, thanks a lot for the call. I really appreciate that. Couple points I want to get into, Ken. First, her question, which is, what message does this send to young fans like her daughter?
Yeah, that's a great point. I appreciate the mention of it. There have been a number of women executives in country music who have made exactly that point. It just says your voice doesn't count. If you do not hear people like you on the radio, we're really saying your voice doesn't count. And, you know, I'm a little conscious here that I'm talking about sexism in the radio industry. And I'm, you know, I'm a white male. But I tell you what drives my passion about this is that I do First Amendment work, free speech work. And what they are doing is saying to an entire gender, you have no voice here. You have no place here. Nothing, no ideas you have that you can set to music are valuable. And it is absolutely a violation of the principles of free expression in America. And it's a terrible lesson for the next generation.
Thanks a lot for that call. Ken Paulson is with us from Middle Tennessee State University, looking at data showing women on country music stations, they get about 10% of the airplay when they get played. It's very often in the off hours, not when people are necessarily listening. Back to your calls now. William is with us in Madison. William, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious if this is a situation just in country music, or is it seen across all genres of music?
William, thanks a lot for the call. And that's been nagging at me a little as we're talking here, Ken. You know, pop music, where would pop music be without Beyoncé's and Rihanna's and Lizzo's and things like that? But if I think about big parts of rock history, the kind of the music that I tune into, that seems like more the exception to hear women on a classic rock station, say.
Well, there's a couple of different issues there. You know, some of the hard rock bands of the 70s, for whatever reason, the Journeys of the World, for whatever reason, they have retained more influence. But if you go back and look at, listen to oldies radio in any market, you're going to hear plenty of Supremes. You're going to hear a ton of Motown. You're going to hear the OJs. So I don't think classic rock is necessarily representative. There are other formats that actually are diverse, and they're just called oldies radio or R&B radio. Having said that, I think what we're looking at in the industry is over time, there's been a lot more reducing the playlist and a lot less risk-taking. And anybody who's worked in radio will tell you there was a time when there was a legendary DJ who would put together their show and decide who to play. I mean, that's part of the legend of Elvis Presley, that Dewey Phillips said, I'm playing this local kid's record. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, they get told what to play. And so the problem is not just a lack of diversity in the musical field. It's largely not a problem. But the problem is what they play. One other point I'd make about current pop music, which also can be repetitive and has a sound that is distinct to this era. But we have extraordinarily prominent young women. We have extraordinarily prominent young men. We have gays. We have people who flirt with every possible orientation. It's incredibly diverse in pop radio. Now, ironically, where it's not diverse is the sound. But the people who make the music are tremendously diverse, and I think we have to acknowledge that.
Time for one more caller. Karen is with us in Augusta. Karen, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great topic, by the way. I'd just like to comment that I like the girl power songs. Fancy, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle Rules the World, Jennifer Nettles, We Do It in Heels. All those girl power songs are a great time to listen to.
Karen, do you want to hear more of that kind of thing on the radio?
Yes.
All right. So there's one audience member, Ken, who wants more of that kind of thing.
I'm confident that as women begin to speak up more, it'll show up in their music. And that's what you're really talking about, the power of music to make an impact, to deliver a message. And we need a lot more of that.
Time for one more caller. She was very concise. Heather is with us in Kaukauna. Heather, hello.
Hello.
What's your question or comment?
I was wondering if the Dixie Chicks had any influence when they were ostracized in the 90s for their political comment. Do you think that had any repercussions for future women being afraid?
That's a great question. It actually happened in 2004, I believe, and their political stance was not, you know, obviously embraced when they said they were embarrassed that President Bush was from Texas on the eve of the Iraq War. It actually, to me, symbolizes just the same problem that's going on forever. When women decide to take a stand in culture, there's a lot more pushback than against men. So, for example, when they made their remarks, it was widely shunned. But when Loretta Lynn in 1974 sang about the pill, that was also banned. Women who cross into politics inevitably get blacklisted or bumped off the air. It's actually pretty tragic.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Ken Paulson, professor of the Recording Industry Department at Middle Tennessee State University. We talked to him about a gender gap on country music radio. Tune in at 8 p.m. this evening to hear a live broadcast of President Trump's address to the nation about the coronavirus. That's this evening at 8 on this WPR station and online at WPR.org.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a former head of the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration shares his concerns about how faulty science can be enshrined in public policy and what the impact can be.
And with a lot of volatility in the stock market because of concerns about the coronavirus pandemic, we'll get an explainer about the Dow Jones and other indices and what they actually mean. All that and more is coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.
Weekdays from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, microplastics have been used in a lot of products over the years, and now they are a big pollution concern in Wisconsin waterways. A researcher tells us about the problem and possible solutions. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, have you enjoyed a graphic novel lately? We'll talk about why some parents are hesitant to let comics be the only books their kids are reading. Our guest librarian says, no, there's still great ways to learn about reading. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is Central Time.